Good morning. This is Focus 580, our telephone talk show, our morning telephone talk show, I should say. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. Our guest during this hour, Focus 580, is someone who has played a key role in some of the most ambitious and exciting projects to explore the outer planet, the other planets in our solar system and beyond. Kenneth Atkins is a manager at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, where he has worked for some 29 years. The many projects he has worked on at JPL include development of the flight software for the Galileo mission, flight operations for Voyager, Galileo, and the Mars Observer, and the Mars Pathfinder mission. Small projects that had some success. And in 1995, Dr. Atkins led the proposal effort for a project called Stardust, and he then became its project manager. Stardust successfully launched on February 7th, 1999, on a six-year round trip to the comet Vild 2. And we'll talk about that during this hour, talk about that mission and some of these others, what we might learn from it, and about the effort to explore deep space. And he's on campus as part of the Unit 1 program. He's been in residence for the past week talking with University of Illinois students and others, and we're glad to have him with us. If you have questions, you're welcome to call us during this hour. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, the other states where you can hear us, 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL if you match the letters with the numbers, or toll-free 800-222-WILL. Dr. Atkins, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure.
We were talking before. I was expressing my enthusiasm about the kind of work you do. It must be amazing to send, in the case of Stardust, it weighs about 700 pounds, this piece of material and, you know, circuitry, shooting it around several, planets. It comes back around Earth. It's almost like it's a bank shot, to the nth degree, to rendezvous with a comet. How do you do that?
Well, we are very fortunate to have a lot of the physics well known in terms of how a spacecraft can pass through the gravity field of a body like Earth or Venus or Jupiter, for example, and add energy to its flight path to take it further and further away from Earth. So what that does for us is it allows us to spend less money on the launch vehicle and sort of get a free crack the whip, if you will, off of one of these planets to take us where we want to go.
The Stardust is part of a series of programs that is under the umbrella of the Discovery Program?
That's correct. Yeah, NASA in its recent history has turned to what we call the faster, better, cheaper approach, which is to do more of these smaller missions with maybe one or two instruments and a principal investigator from a university. And the Discovery Program is a series that has had four already launched and some completed. Stardust was the fourth in that series. It included Lunar Prospector, which was a flight back to the moon to check for water, and then what we call the Near-Earth Asteroid Rendezvous, which was carried out by the Applied Physics Lab over in Maryland and actually rendezvoused with an asteroid called Eros and softly touched down at the end of the mission, which was about a month or so ago. And then, of course, the very famous Mars Pathfinder with the Sojourner rover. And Discovery 4 was then selected as Stardust to actually try to get to a comet, collect some of the dust near the comet's head, and actually bring it home.
That seems to me, I mean, it's out of science fiction. I mean, how do you, I mean, let's back up a little bit, and let me ask you, what's so interesting about visiting a comet?
Well, first let me tell everybody that I'm an engineer, not necessarily a scientist, even though they often refer to people at Jet Propulsion Laboratory as the scientists at JPL, which, we engineers like to get our time in the spotlight, too. But you hear a lot. And, the scientists are the customers in terms of the passengers that we're trying to take to learn something and bring knowledge back to our planet. In the case of comets, the scientific community believes that they represent sort of a time capsule, if you will, looking back at materials that have been unchanged and remnants of the solar nebula before the solar system was formed and Earth came into being some 4.5 billion years ago. So the idea is to collect some of this material and then attempt to deduce, understand how and what the processes have been that have led to our solar system and what we have become.
Mm-hmm. And the project is designed to collect material and bring it back to Earth.
Right.
How do you go about that?
Well, one of the things that is very, very interesting about something like Stardust is exactly that challenge, to collect these particles. It turns out that selecting a comet like VIL-2 was done because we could keep the relative speed between the spacecraft and the comet down into a reasonable level so we could spend more time and go a little bit slower. Mm-hmm. You'd think that 6 times the speed of a rifle bullet is not slow. But in terms of that kind of challenge, it is. And what we've come up with is a material, we call it aerogel, which is basically 99.9% empty. It's a structure that's like a glass foam, and it's clear because it's sort of made out of silicon and the way you make glass and so on. And it has a capability of when a particle hits it at that kind of speed of forming a little melt, sort of a very tiny reentry shield, if you will, around the particle and then stopping it inside the aerogel in a very, very short distance. So we have these little maybe a centimeter and a half, 2 centimeters, or maybe 3/4 inch to 3-inch tiles that we put in a matrix that looks something like the head of an oversized tennis racket that we stick up into the dust stream as we go through the comet, and the particles actually embed themselves, and then we'll put that into the little sample return capsule, which weighs about 150 pounds and is about, it's only about a meter and a half across in diameter. And then we'll use the main spacecraft to bring that back to Earth and drop it out in Utah in 2006.
I think. Right. Yeah. And so this will parachute down.
Right. It parachutes down. It comes into the atmosphere at the slow speed of 28,000 miles an hour. That's about 6,000 miles an hour faster than the returns on the Apollo that came back from the moon in the 70s.
Could you explain about this mission and the how do you go about figuring out the rendezvous? I mean, you have to go around several different paths to gain speed. Could you sort of explain the flight path?
Sure. We launched there in February of 1999, and the energy that we put in with a Boeing Delta II rocket was not enough to take us out to the orbit of VIL-2. And the objective that we have, of course, is to cross that orbit at exactly the right time. We play a cosmic billiard shot, if you will. And so we took the spacecraft one loop around the sun, and that took us until this last January to go out from February 99 until January here in 2001, as we passed very close to the Earth, some 3,600 kilometers altitude off the west coast of South Africa at the closest approach, and passing through the Earth's gravitational field, added energy, as we've discussed, and then that gives us enough boost to put us out across the orbit of VIL-2. Now, the first time we cross the orbit of VIL-2, the comet's not there. So we sort of have to loop around the sun for another couple of years, go way out of about 2.75 astronomical units, and an astronomical unit is a distance from the Earth to the Sun, about 93 million miles.
Okay.
And that'll take us around and back through the same vicinity where the Earth was when we made the gravity assist, but the Earth won't be there the next time we come. And then in 2004, we'll be right in front of that comet's path when it passes across the orbit, the trajectory of the spacecraft. So effectively, the comet will run over the spacecraft, and we'll be behind some shields. We put the spacecraft itself behind some shields, which basically consist of a couple of plates of aluminum and composite material, and we hang 3 sheets of Nexel, which is bulletproof vest material, between the plates, so that a particle coming through will be stopped before it gets into the electronics of the spacecraft. And so we then stick our tennis racket up from behind this fort, and the particles impact the aerogel. Now, if we get a big particle, the grid in the collector is basically open all the way through, but filled with these small aerogel tiles. Mm-hmm. So there are enough of the of these little matrix tiles that if one gets knocked out, it still means that we'll be able to collect plenty of particles, and our objective is to bring at least 1,000 particles back to the Earth when we come back in 2006. So the idea of getting those particles back is, you know, it looks complicated, but the laws of physics help us to make it.
It seems to me that just designing this flight path is, I suppose this is old hat now to JPL, but there might be some math involved in that.
Well, there is, and this technique of gravity assist has been known, you know, since the 70s when some of the engineers and scientists at JPL and around NASA discovered that they could actually pass objects through the fields of these planets and pick up speed. And, of course, that was the technique that we used when we launched Voyager back in 1977, which is a long, long time ago, and we used that technique off of Jupiter to take us on a tour all the way through the outer planets. So we passed Jupiter, took pictures, Saturn took pictures, Uranus took pictures, and Neptune. So we've covered the waterfront in a reconnaissance mode and got those pictures that many of us have seen in National Geographic or on TV or places where we've learned more about the solar system during the last 30 years than man has known since the history of man. It's sort of amazing to think sometimes that 100 years ago we couldn't even fly.
Indeed. Well, let me just take a moment to reintroduce and invite people into the conversation. Our guest, Kenneth Atkins, he's a manager at Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. He's been involved in some of the most exciting and successful efforts to explore the planets and other bodies around the solar system here. And he's visiting campus to take part in a guest-in-residence program at Unit 1 at the University of Illinois. And we're talking about the Stardust Project and a variety of other missions JPL has going. If you'd like to ask questions, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Once you launch something like Stardust, you know, and presumably you've got the flight path all calculated correctly and it's going to go where you intend it and rendezvous with the comet, is it necessary to correct its course at all? I mean, how do you track it and how do you manage that?
Well, that's absolutely. We've got to keep it on course. We have a series of antennas that are placed equidistant around the world at Goldstone, California, in Canberra, Australia, and in Madrid, Spain. And these sets of antennas that some are 34 meters in diameter and others are 210, you know, very, very large antennas, are placed there because as the Earth spins and one of these sort of goes over the horizon from the spacecraft's perspective, the next appears and is able to then contact and talk to the spacecraft. And we get radio signals that come down from the spacecraft, and these signals then, we use things like the Doppler effect and others to tell us pretty much how far the spacecraft is away and what its speed is and kind of where it is relative to the trajectory that we planned it to be on. As time goes on, if it drifts because of solar pressures and small forces that might move it around, gravitational pull from some of the planets, it'll get off course. So then we plan some specific points along the flight path to use onboard propulsion and then move us back or take us from the point where we find we are back on course and, you know, back toward the target. So that's how we do it. We talk to the spacecraft over the Deep Space Net. Maybe once, twice a week, looking at the health of all the subsystems on board. Navigators are checking, you know, the position of the spacecraft, and then we're continuing to plan and look at how things are going.
Well, we have a caller to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. A listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, this will be brief. I was wondering if I've heard an engineering professor say that they let their students, their students about to graduate, they tell them or they show them a circuit, electrical circuit, and they say, can this work? Yeah, I mean, is this a viable circuit? And all the students will have learned that it's not, and then they actually produce a radio that has this circuit or something like that along those lines, and thereby proving that, they better keep their eyes open in the future when they're actually working, because some of this stuff goes beyond what they've learned. And I was just wondering if I have two questions. One is, these students that come out of astrophysics, I guess, would be one of the main disciplines. Is there anything like that they would have come up against when they actually get to NASA, or do they? You know, is the theory pretty much what they find in the reality? I'll ask them one question and the other.
Okay, this business of making sure that you know that things will work is a very important of the process that we call the integration and test and verification validation in a project development. It's sort of along the adage of you do the design work and put all the knowledge that you understand in it, but then you can trust, but you must verify. And what we have is an ethic in doing these projects that says that we want to know the bad news early, because once we know the bad news, then we can make the corrections and correct our own inertia of belief, if you will, that says, well, we thought this was going to work the way it is, the way we designed it, and then it turns out that it didn't. And quite frankly, that always happens on development of a project like this. So what we have is a process which we call the problem failure reporting process, where anyone working on a project that discovers something that doesn't look right or doesn't work as it was advertised writes up a report, and then this is formally put into a tracking system and must have a response in order to work it off. And as we go through the project, review boards then look at how we're doing on all of the problems that we found, and we put this through a pretty heavy scrutiny to make sure that we keep the risks on these projects as low as we possibly can.
Oh, wow. Sounds like we ought to retrain you guys to go into biotechnology there.
Well, we've been on the peaks and also in the valleys. As you know, we've lost a few spacecraft, and we lost a couple at Mars, which we'll be talking about tonight over at Allen Hall in Unit 1 about the lessons of failure.
Yeah, well, success doesn't seem to really overwhelm the failures, but I had another last question,
sure.
And I'll hang up. I was just curious if you guys think you could have brought the mirror down any better than Russians did, or any comment about that, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things that's very good about the people who navigate these machines in space, either from orbit or from returns from planets or attempting to land on other planets, is that we have some of the best and brightest navigators, and we understand the atmosphere. And this has been shared from a standpoint of the international cooperation. As you'll remember, we've had a long history of working with Russian engineers and scientists on a number of missions, and we've helped them out lots of times and been working together on different projects and programs back in the early 80s when a set of unmanned spacecraft was hurled at Halley's Comet, for example. Mm-hmm. People ran into difficulties in Europe, and the Russians had spacecraft up there as well, and the United States certainly helped navigate that. So we all know the principles and the processes. So I'd say they did an outstanding job at bringing that machine down, particularly when they were looking at firing thrusters to deorbit the craft that hadn't been used in a very long time.
We have another caller waiting on line number 4 in Belgium. Let's talk with them. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. A couple questions. The first one, you're talking about your checking your problems. If I understand right, one of these trips to Mars here recently, the problem was that some people use metric and some people use English units in producing this thing. I would have thought you never would have got the two pieces to go together, screw together, wherever you had to screw them together.
Well, it wasn't about screwing something together in that case, because this had to do with software files. Where you're looking at numbers.
Oh, I see. So you didn't have to worry about physical things. You worried about your distances and stuff like that.
Well, it was in a software file, and a set of numbers that were supposed to be in metrics were entered in terms of the English system.
Yes, okay.
And when the folks were basically looking at the numbers, it it wasn't clear on one side what they were looking at. But when they processed those through the computer, there was some unease that built, because this had to do with some of the very small forces that were building up on the spacecraft to move it off of its trajectory, as we discussed earlier.
I see.
And because we were working in a faster, better, cheaper mode, and we're trying to keep the cost down, the full process of taking this unease by a small cadre of navigators and saying, this just doesn't feel right and I ought to write this up, that process wasn't followed appropriately. And instead, there were some emails used and some more informal things. And that caused the system to break down, such that as we approached the planet, Mars, and this unease was sort of still there, it got to the project management put them in a corner, because we would have had to do a maneuver that would raise the orbit just about the same time that the team was beginning to start the sequence to clock out the burn for orbit insertion on the rockets that were aboard the vehicle. And some of the information was a little bit, it wasn't as clear as to where the spacecraft was, and so there was a sort of a, well, let's believe it's okay, because the risk of performing both of these maneuvers right on top of each other was probably more than what we thought we would be experiencing in terms of margin above the atmosphere at Mars, and that turned out to be wrong.
So you could have fixed it if you had had enough time to know.
Correct. And if we'd have followed the processes, we would have been able to know a few months earlier that we had this issue and could have acted to move the trajectory of the spacecraft a good distance above the atmosphere of Mars.
And the last question I had, now you're sending these things from here on Earth to God only knows how many miles and into the void, and it seems to me you would have a problem of making sure things worked when you got to the end of the trip, that something didn't freeze. How do you keep things from just getting so cold that they won't work?
Well, the history and experience that we've had in unmanned robotic space projects has a very, very heavy discipline in what we call thermal control. And so aboard the spacecraft, where we have the electronics that are, in some cases sun-powered and in other cases nuclear-powered, we match that with what we call multi-layer insulation, which is a lightweight blanket, if you will, that we put around the electronics and around the spacecraft.
So you have a heat source inside. Obviously, if you say nuclear, there's some sort of heat source if you need it.
Right. Those have been used on some of the missions. They're called radioisotope heater units, RHUs. Now they have been used on some of the outer planet missions, where you just go so far from the sun that you can't use the sunlight and the electricity created by that to perform heat. Now on Stardust, for example, we have none of those RHUs aboard, because we're able to use the sunlight coming through solar cells to heat electronics and also electronic heaters aboard to keep the electronics in the zone that we've tested them for.
Oh, so in some cases you do need a nuclear-type heaters and sometimes you don't.
Correct.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for the call. Still, I can imagine there would be unforeseen circumstances. I don't know, would solar storms be something that would disrupt, that could conceivably disrupt the entire mission? Or
absolutely. Yeah. In fact, one of the things that you learn is that once you've done the development and actually successfully separated from that very dangerous thing that we call the launch rocket, which is a huge explosive control to drive you off the planet, then you're in deep space where you can't pull over to the side of the road and fix something. And if you have software bugs or if some of your equipment might malfunction, you must have in place what we call a fault protection system, which is a combination of software and other techniques, redundancy in terms of some of the boxes and electronics aboard to make sure you've got backups. Now, it turns out that in flight, Murphy lives, and what will go wrong sometimes and usually does. Mm-hmm. And so on Stardust, for example, we've had a number of events that have caused us to go to safe mode, and then we've been successful in bringing the spacecraft back out with its robust design. We're very, very proud of that spacecraft. It really is tough. And the just before Christmas here, well, it was in December, I believe, we experienced the worst solar flare in 40 years that blew through this area of the solar system. And a number of satellites were disrupted, and Stardust was no exception. What happened was that the flood of protons disrupted the electronic imaging in the star camera, which is part of the attitude control system, and overwhelmed it to the point where we went through several elements of the fault protection routine using the second star camera, which is the backup, and ending up in what we call a terminal safe mode, which is just sort of coning about the sun line while we maintained enough sun on the solar rays to keep all of the subsystems warm and the batteries with enough power. And we could hear the spacecraft on these antennas on Earth about 15 minutes out of every hour weekly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, very weak signal was coming down.
Yes.
But it gave us enough data to understand that the spacecraft systems were basically okay and that it was the solar flare that had disrupted the electronics. And this dissipates over a short period of time. So the flight team elected to leave the spacecraft there for a couple of days until that charge had dissipated, and then we were able to re-energize the star cameras. They saw what they wanted to see, the star pattern that's on board that says, okay, we're looking at something we understand, and we brought the spacecraft out and then successfully did the Earth Gravity Assist.
Amazing. Well, we're a little past our midpoint with Dr. Kenneth Atkins from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He's been involved in some of the most interesting, successful efforts to explore the solar system, and we're talking about that. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Computers would obviously play a crucial role in, you know, the engineering of the craft, I'm sure. And computers are notoriously imperfect. And I guess I'm assuming that you don't use Windows 95 on these machines.
No, we don't. There is a history and lore and also a strong discipline in what we call flight software. Mm-hmm. Now, NASA and most of us in robotic spacecraft have grown up with more of a hardware culture. And so there is a sort of a culture clash between the software folks and the hardware folks. You implement some functions in hardware, and you implement other functions in the software sequencing that you put aboard. We use a computer. It's called a RAD 6000. It's a good space computer made by it's owned by Lockheed Martin now. It used to be IBM, and then it was Loral, and so, you know, in the merger world, it goes
sure.
on. It ended up under Lockheed Martin. And the computer has done a very, very good job for us in these kinds of missions. And we like to, you know, use the same computer as much as we can while certainly letting the technology move forward so we can do more. Mm-hmm. It certainly turns out that, you know, some of the computers that we have on our desktop have more power than more computing power, if you will, than what we have aboard the spacecraft. But from the perspective of the reliability and the understanding, we choose to, you know, go very conservatively, and we've had great success with the processes that we've used.
Do you use a standard operating system or a custom? I mean, is it a Unix, or you come up with some other custom design?
It's not a Unix. It's more of a custom design that is put together by a set of contractors, and then we basically use a similar operating system, and then the code is done in a C++, I believe, as opposed to, you know, one of the other more esoteric things like Ada or BASIC, or I mean, BASIC's not esoteric, but you know, the objective would be to get to where you have more what we call an object-oriented approach or a functionally grouped approach, where you don't have quite so much intricacies, and a single element of code would be able to be used over and over because it does the same function.
Excuse me for sort of slipping into geek mode here, but I guess I'm just really curious about this. Is a lot of this code inherited from long ago? Is this stuff that you're developing?
One of the things that helps us to keep the costs under control, yeah, and to make good estimates when we're attempting to do something that in many cases has never been done before, mm-hmm, is to try to inherit as much as we possibly can. Mm-hmm. That includes both hardware and software. For example, both Mars 98 and the Stardust vehicles and systems were both were all built by Lockheed Martin Astronautics in Denver. And, of course, they have other programs that are done for the Defense Department. And one of the inheritances that was used for those three missions, the Mars and Stardust. I say three because in the Mars 98, there were actually two spacecraft. One was a climate orbiter, and the other was supposed to be a lander.
Yes.
And then Stardust was the third being done almost at the same time. And so what was done there was an inheritance of a software set from one of the Defense Department satellites that had been put together. And this was then modified and put in use for us on deep space.
Okay. Just curious about that. Well, we just have about 15 minutes left with our guest, Kenneth Atkins. I'll mention the phone numbers one more time. If you'd like to ask any questions of your own, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. I wanted to ask, and I don't remember exactly which mission this was. About a month ago, there was a probe that was actually landed on. Was it Eros?
Eros.
Yes.
Right.
I did not hear the results of that. I don't know why I didn't pay attention or something. But can you?
Right. Eros was one of the Discovery series, and the objective was to perform the first ever rendezvous with what we would call a near-Earth asteroid. In the asteroid belt, there are some that are closer to Earth and some that are further out in the asteroid belt. Some of these actually may even cross Earth's path or be in the vicinity of Earth, and of course we watch those very carefully. Part of the objective of a mission like near-Earth asteroid rendezvous is to learn more about these bodies, understand their structure, and put that into our knowledge base in case we have to either move one or blow one up someday.
Right.
And so the idea of NIR was to do that kind of job. It certainly did a great job of rendezvousing and staying in the vicinity of that asteroid for a period of time well beyond the operational period that had been assigned for that project. At the end, then, the flight controller said, well, let's check out, what the structure of this thing's like by, in a sense, crashing the spacecraft into the surface. So they navigated this down very slowly, and we're going to try to softly touch down. And it turned out that they were so good at this that they touched down, and the thing still worked after it touched on the surface, and we were able to get some pictures very close.
What did we learn from that? I mean, did we learn the composition of this asteroid? What kind of information came back?
Well, I'm sure that they're processing a lot of that information now, and I'm sure that they, will learn things like how dry it is, exactly how close is it to the sort of materials that we understand in our own moon, for example, and on the basis of that, we'll be able to understand what the what maybe the depth of information is, or you know how tough the structure is,
mm-hmm.
and those kind of things will be important to us. And also, how do these materials, which have basically been unchanged over long, long periods of time, compare with the kind of materials that we might get back from a comet?
Very interesting. Are we still getting information from Eros?
No, I think that once they touched down on the surface, that it didn't last too long after that.
It's pretty amazing, though. I mean, it wasn't planned. It was just, you know, the flight controller said, hey, the thing is still functioning. Let's see if we can, you know, do something really interesting here.
Right. There are those serendipitous opportunities that sometimes come up. For example, if you're flying a trajectory and it turns out that you might be able to go close to one of these asteroids and make a comparison by taking some pictures of it on your way someplace else, then there's always the possibility that you could propose to do such a thing, get some additional antenna time, mm-hmm. since that has to be shared with all the flight projects that are in deep space, and actually carry this thing out. So you can get these serendipitous type of encounters.
There have been other probes that have outlasted their presumed lifetime. I believe wasn't Voyager one of those?
Absolutely. Voyager had two spacecraft that were sent partly for redundancy in case one didn't work when we launched back in 1977. And one of those is, you know, just passing through what we call the heliopause. That's the boundary between our solar system and true interstellar space. And it's been flying all that time, and we're actually still in contact with it. There's a great worry as you're going through the development that you will experience what we would call infant mortality in either the avionics or in some of the subsystems. But we find that once we get through a good solid burn-in period, and we try to do a lot of that on the ground before we ever launch, that it's hard to kill these things. They are very robust and can last a lot longer than we even expected them to work. For example, we never envisioned being able to go all the way out to Neptune, and the ways that the radios were designed on Voyager wouldn't allow us to communicate with what was, you know, what we knew about the ground and being able to pick the signals up and so on. And during that period of time, we were able to what we call arraying some of the antennas on the ground in order to get a stronger signal from a lot further distance, and through that technique actually get those pictures back from Neptune.
That's simply amazing.
It's incredible.
And that was launched in 1977?
1977, and so imagine how old the technology is.
Right, and it's still going. It's
still going.
Yeah. What about the other Voyager probe?
The other Voyager probe we turned off. You have many other folks in line for the use of the Deep Space Network, and it was in a trajectory that was taking it into an area that was not favorable for us to, you know, use gravity assist to go on to some of the other planets. They weren't flying at exactly the same flight path. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, we turned one of them off at the end of mission.
So how many missions are there currently out there?
Well, it's, you know, if you walk through them, we've got Deep Space One, which is on its way and should be encountering a comet to sort of take pictures. That's a technology flight that's testing an advanced propulsion system called ion propulsion, which uses electronically charged particles as the exhaust gas. We've got Stardust. We have Cassini that's on its way to Saturn. We have Voyagers we've talked about, and we have Galileo that's still in orbit about Jupiter. Those are the flights that are currently working, and we have, you know, some others. We're planning to launch one here in April called Mars Odyssey, and it is to put another orbiter about Mars following up the loss of our climate orbiter, you know, a couple of years ago.
Is that similar to the 98 Mars?
Yeah, it'll be very similar. We're trying to make sure that we replace the information and the objectives that we were attempting to do then, and we'd like to, you know, make sure we fill in that gap. We're going to need a communication link that's in orbit around Mars. Once we successfully put down landers and they're in more remote spots so that we could use it as a relay.
So there are more landers planned in the coming
right
years.
Right now, we're working in the early phases of development for landing two spacecraft that will launch in 2003, aimed at Mars to sort of repeat the Pathfinder experience. They'll use airbags to bounce off the surface, and same teams are working on these two missions, and we're doing two to make sure that we have good backup and redundancy.
I'm just really curious how all this relates to the, presumably continuation of human beings going into space, and how the science, the things that you're learning from these projects can be fed back into, sending people.
Sure. Well, one of the, we've had a history where, before we went to the moon, we didn't know whether the surface of the moon was like a powder or a quicksand type thing that you would just sink into, or whether it was strong enough to actually support a spacecraft. So the Jet Propulsion Laboratory played a very key support role in something like that by sending the Ranger series, which actually, came and impacted the moon. Mm-hmm. And we sent about six or seven of those. And then we had the Surveyor program, which actually, landed a spacecraft on the surface and proved that the surface could sustain a pretty significant weight, which mm-hmm. led to knowledge about how to build the lunar excursion module and the lander, for example. And from a Mars perspective, be very, very important for us to find water if we could. So, part of the scientific interest in Mars is to, quote, follow the water and look at some of these flow fields and see if there may be some subsurface water. If we could find that, it would certainly drive down the risk and make it a lot easier for us to sustain a human presence on a planet.
Very interesting. Well, we have just about 5 minutes left. If people want to call real quick, we'll try to get you in, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. The fortunes of the effort to explore the solar system have sort of risen and fallen, and I guess every time you have success, you got to feel, you've proven that this is worthwhile. And when something like Mars 98 happens, obviously it's a setback. But I suppose, and JPL has long played a key role in developing the technology and directing the missions and so forth. Do you sense that the political climate is changing more in the direction of, going into space, especially with the space station now coming into reality?
Well, we've been very, very fortunate, I think, as a nation to be a spacefaring nation that has the luxury of spending a part of our national treasure to just learn what's out there. There's always been that piece of us, I think, that wants to know what's over the next hill, or do some kind of an exploration and understand what the unknown is about. NASA's budget runs about between $13 and $14 billion out of over $1 trillion national budget. So it's a pretty small percentage when it comes right down to how much we spend on space. And the scientific part of that, both Earth orbiting and deep space, has been very, very strongly supported by NASA because, we're interested in how we got here and what the Earth is about and what our future may hold. And in that sense, I think that the nation has been very, very generous in supporting these kinds of efforts. And as we found out with the Pathfinder, when you land on an unknown surface and you suddenly open that for everybody to view, you get a tremendous outpouring of interest. With robotics and with some of the video techniques we can use, with some of the digital, increase in data links that we can envision, it's not beyond imagination to actually think about having people in their homes be able to sort of ride along on a small airplane that's taking movies as it flies down the Mariner Canyon on the surface of Mars, which is, five times as deep as the Grand Canyon, and if it were put on Earth, would run from Los Angeles to New York. I mean, there are some very, very interesting geological features that that we can explore. So from that perspective, I think we've had great support from the country.
Another question about the relationship between, you know, I suppose, the science and the society at large is the educational institutions that are involved in this. I mean, you have essentially partnerships with, I don't know exactly the extent, but University of Washington in the case of Stardust.
Right. One of the things that NASA did to perform outreach and get more of us involved, more scientists involved, was to put this discovery program in place. And the way that works is that there's an announcement of opportunity that goes out that NASA's ready to select a new project. And university researchers from around the country can then put together a team with an industrial partner or a government partner that would build and launch a project. And then they go into a competition. Stardust, for example, was selected out of over 28 proposals that came from a number of university scientists and teams around the country. So I think this is just absolutely great that scientists then become sort of the real boss, if you will, and responsible for the exploration. And then the NASA team, for example, on Stardust, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, carried out the project management with the industrial partner building the flight system.
Well, we're just about the point we're going to have to stop, and there's much more we could talk about. I'm curious, as a pilot yourself.
Correct.
Have you ever dreamed of yourself going on a space mission?
Well, it was very interesting. My piloting career started back in the early days when the Mercury 7 were just coming along, and I had had the experience of being in unusual attitudes in many different aircraft during that period of time, and of course there was a strong tug between should I go on to test pilot school or should I, you know, pursue a degree in higher education, et cetera. And although I was torn between those two, I did have a commitment to keep flying. But at the same time, I felt that continuing my education was important and also completing my flying career is important. Certainly, yes, there has been that. But at the same time, when I ended up with a young family, there were some pressures on me that were beyond what my own personal desires might have been. So that was one of the big reasons that I did not pursue that direction.
Well, in another sense, you've been involved in missions that have enabled you to see with, you know, from another vantage point much further than you could have gone personally.
Right. In this case, by working on specific hardware, I think it really does challenge the engineering side of a personality. And, you know, there are old pilots and bold pilots and no old bold pilots. And after a while, your skills, your physical skills relative to just being a good flyer would be overshadowed by the younger, bolder folks that come along. But in the case of working on engineering activities, you can always be right there.
Well, we're going to have to stop because we're at the end of our time. Our guest has been Kenneth Atkins. He's a longtime manager at Jet Propulsion Laboratory and has been good enough to spend a week here at the Unit 1 program at the University of Illinois. And by the way, he will be speaking tonight, we think 9 o'clock, in the South Rec Room of Allen Hall, speaking about lessons from Mars 98. And I'm sure that you'd be welcome to attend that. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.